Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. Once part of the ATA tribe, you'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we are very excited to welcome back Veronica Bautau to the show for the second time. Veronica is the founder of Dog Biz, the dog pro industry's leading business consultancy, through which she has been helping dog trainers help dogs since 2003. She is the author of How to Run a Dog Business, Putting Your Career Where Your Heart Is, Minding Your Dog Business, A Practical Guide to Business Success for Dog Professionals, and The Business of Dog Walking, How to Make a Living Doing What You Love. She also writes regular business columns and articles for many dog training industry journals, including those of the US, New Zealand, and Australian APDTs. Veronica is a sought-after speaker at conferences and dog training schools across the US and internationally, including her two favorite places to visit and work, New Zealand and Australia, which she is excited to be heading back to soon. More on that later. As former director of behavior and training at the San Francisco SPCA, and as a dog training business owner before that, Veronica understands what it means to be a dog trainer firsthand. The daily worries about everything from client compliance to financial security, the unique challenges of a flexible schedule that requires evenings and weekends, and the struggle to balance clients and training with the details of running a business, and to balance all of that with a rich non-work life. Her background as a trainer, her business expertise, and her work as an educator put Veronica in a unique position to help professional dog trainers learn to become as skilled in business as they are as trainers. And that means more dogs' lives touched by positive training. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome back to the show today, Veronica Bautau, who is patiently waiting by. Veronica, hi, how are you?
I'm great, Ryan. It's so great to be back. Thank you for having me again.
Oh, an absolute pleasure. I always jump at any opportunity to talk to you and to learn from you. I learned so much in our last podcasts. And I know that ATA members did as well, because that specific episode gets linked to many times in our online community areas. And I shared a post of you just the other day, didn't I? One of our members, Wesley from Seattle, saying how much his business has grown since listening to that episode and reaching out to Dog Biz after that. So your ripples are huge, Veronica.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad to hear that. That makes my heart sing. We really do live to hear those stories.
Definitely. And so for those listening, if you haven't listened to that earlier episode, we will link to it in the show notes, or you can find it in your podcast app. So go back and listen to what was episode 54 from April last year, where we had Veronica on the show for the first time. So since then, 15 months have passed. And I know, Veronica, 15 months means massive approximations in working towards her goals. So fill us in, Veronica. What's been going on since April last year?
Oh, well, the biggest thing we've been working on is launching our new program, Dog Biz University, which is essentially an online business school for dog trainers. And so we have been super busy all year long creating courses for that and getting those up. And we've got a whole, I think we've done about eight classes this year. Some are on demand, some are live classes. So we've just been putting all kinds of content out for that. So that's been very exciting. And then gearing up for some travel to do some in-person teaching again later this year.
So how does one find out more about Dog Biz University? And is it like a course with a time frame, or is it just access to information you go through at your own time, or how's it work?
Yeah, it depends on the course. So Dog Biz University is basically our collection of business classes. And so some of them are on demand where you could decide that you wanted to take them tomorrow. You register and all the lessons are there for you to take at your own pace. Some of the classes we are doing live. And so you register by a certain date and then come on and do a live interactive course. Some of them are a bit of a mixture, where you have access to the pre-recorded modules, but then we also have scheduled group coaching calls to get on and do Q&A and do some problem solving and actually take what we're teaching and apply it to your own business. So we're experimenting with sort of a wide range of formats to see what works best. And, you know, for some topics, you know, some formats work better than others. And so we're just playing quite a bit with that. We've just, later this month, for example, we'll be releasing an on-demand course on how to set up and structure a successful day training program. So that's one that you can take, you know, just whenever you like. We've got courses on marketing and setting rates and all sorts of things. And in September, we are doing our first fully live course, and it's a 5-week course on called The Best Classes in Town, a really comprehensive kind of deep dive into creating a really successful public class program, you know, solving a lot of the common problems that we run into with filling classes and getting people to come back after puppy and basic and just, you know, all sorts of different issues. And so you can go to dogbizsuccess.com and click the Dog Biz University tab, and you can see all the courses that we've got going and the ones that are coming up next, and take a look.
Yeah, I think that public class is one of the ATA membership and the conversations in the community areas are anything to go by. Is going to be a popular one. We've got a unit set up in our Facebook group just for people having discussions about what they do in their classes, and it seems to be a recurring question, and it seems to be one that gets a lot of engagement from the members. So I'm excited to hear that that's being offered.
Yeah, I'm excited too. It's my... you know, my original career was in education and curriculum development and teaching teachers and that sort of thing. So I get really excited about the intersection between that and dog training. And, you know, and it doesn't surprise me that that's a topic that gets a lot of play, because you think about how complex teaching classes is. I mean, of all of the different kinds of services that you can offer as a dog professional, classes is the most challenging. You think about the business side of things and how, you know, all the stars have to align, right? People have to know that your class exists. They have to know before the start date, the day and the time have to work. And there, you know, there's all of that complexity. But then you think about, not only do you have to be a great trainer, you also have to be a really good one-on-one coach. You have to be a really good group instructor. You have to understand how curriculum works. You got to deal with all the classroom management stuff. And then you throw into that just the complexity of the group situation with people coming at all different levels of experience and skill, and how do you, you know, how do you manage that in a group setting? So there's just so much going on that makes classes particularly challenging. But the good news is that, you know, these are all really, really solvable problems, and there are a lot of, you know, for some people, it's about making a few tweaks here and there, and suddenly just the whole thing falls into place. And sometimes it's about kind of stepping back and starting from scratch, moving away from some of the common mistakes and errors that that have just been kind of, you know, passed down from generation of trainer to generation of trainer. You're really thinking outside the box about how classes can look quite different than the typical model that we tend to inherit.
Another question I had is just thinking about what I've been observing and thinking about what you've been up to in the last 15 months, creating this online resource and experimenting, I think was a word that you potentially might have used there, if not something similar to that, with how that all looks. Have you found, as the founder of Dog Tech and working with your team, that more and more people are moving their businesses online? I'm saying that as if you're going to say yes, but maybe the answer is no. Like, is that a trend you're seeing? Are dog trainers getting online more to help people?
You mean dog trainers with their actual businesses?
Yeah, and doing consultancy and stuff.
A little bit. I wouldn't say that it's a massive trend at this point, but we are definitely, you know, more of our consulting clients are starting to ask about the viability of that and what it might look like. It's interesting. I think it's really early days. You know, I'm seeing some people have a little bit more success with it than others. Obviously, you know, it's hard, as an educator, it's been a little bit of a jump for me even to do what we're doing online, which in many ways feels very logical because it's impossible for us to travel enough to be able to be present for everyone. And so it makes sense to do this. But I have to say that even though I think online education has come an awful long way and there's so much we can do with it and so much richer than it used to be, you know, there's no substitute for in person, right? And it's one thing to, you know, to teach business concepts and skills and implementation this way. You think about, you know, it's a really interesting challenge to work with people who are working with dogs and trying to develop skills to do that online. There are some places in which we're seeing a lot more of it. Separation anxiety is the main trend. You know, Milena DeMartini has, you know, just done phenomenal, groundbreaking work in finding much, much more powerful and effective ways to treat separation anxiety. And she does all of her work with clients all around the world online. She, you know, it's exceedingly rare that she meets a client and dog in person. And through her program, she's teaching trainers how to do the same thing. And for that, we're seeing tremendous results. But that's a little bit different than, for example, treating leash reactivity, right? And so I don't know. I think it kind of remains to be seen at this point what all of that ends up looking like. We do have some clients in some areas that are doing some really interesting experimentation. Like I've got a client in London, for example, who does her initial consult in person and then does all of her support work online in really unique and innovative ways, primarily in that case to solve the puzzle of London traffic, to be able to be more present. You know, she had the goal of wanting to do something along the lines of day training where she wasn't just leaving her clients to their own devices for a week at a time, you know, where the support was much more active, but not willing, and even really, it just wasn't feasible to try to be driving to everyone, you know, on a regular basis. So I don't know. There's some interesting experimenting going on, but I think it's a trickle so far, not a huge trend just yet.
That's very cool to hear. I like you are doing experimenting in this area as well. So it's fun to hear what other people are up to, and just want to put a shout out to Melina. We love her here at ATA and agree that the work she's doing with separation anxiety is amazing. I can't wait to have a free calendar year so I can dive in or longer to her content and learn even more from her, I should say. Moving forward, though, you offered to bust some dog training professional myths for us today. To be precise, 8 business myths of dog training professionals. Can you run through these for us, please, Veronica?
Yeah, so this is what I'm going to be talking about in detail when I come out to visit, which I'm super excited about. So there are... I would say that there are more than 8, but these are the main 8 that I'm going to be focusing on. One is this just still pervasive myth that that we aren't skilled professionals with a professional knowledge and skill set, that we don't sort of see ourselves often in the same light as, say, a professional CPA or you know, a lawyer, or, you know, people who other people hire to provide professional skill sets. And that particular myth leads into a couple of others. One of them it's related to is this notion that clients have to train their own dogs, and all of the trouble that that tends to get us into, including our constant frustration with client compliance levels. So clients not doing the work that we really wish that they would do, because they don't have that professional knowledge and skill set, and also because they are accustomed to hiring people to do things for them, which, because we don't see ourselves that way, we continue to hold back you know, what it is the clients really want from us. I think also related to that too is that we don't we're uncomfortable promoting ourselves. We see marketing as some sort of self-aggrandizement that is somehow untoward and slimy and uncomfortable, which, you know, done in certain ways, I suppose it can be, but it certainly doesn't have to be done that way. But I think a huge part of the discomfort around that is our lack of confidence in what it is that we have to offer, which leads into another one, which is that we really don't charge professional rates for the work that we do. Which means that, you know, we don't make the income that we could. And a lot of times with our rates, we self-perpetuate the myth that we aren't skilled, because our rates don't reflect that. So, you know, we've got sort of all of that going on, and then you mix all of this together and you also get the discomfort about selling. So, you know, we don't want to market, but we also are so uncomfortable when we actually get a client. We're so uncomfortable saying to them, this is how I can help you, and this is what I recommend. And if, you know, if you'd like me to assist you, this is what it will look like. We kind of, you know, tend to wait for the client to say, well, okay, can you come back or tell us what they need, or, you know, or we sell, you know, far less training than is actually necessary to get the job done for the client. So that hurts us financially, but more importantly, I think it hurts the dog as well. And so we've got, you know, all of these notions about, you know, that no one's going to hire us if it's not cheap, that we can't market ourselves without, you know, without being, you know, somehow inappropriate. And so you get all this together. And I mean, really, to me, I think it all leads up to this one really, really huge myth, which is that you can't make a living as a dog trainer. And I know that some of your listeners, I'm sure, know that that's not true because they're doing it right now. But I bet you that we've all heard that myth a number of times. And it's always funny to me because, given what I have been doing for a living for 16 years, which is helping people make a living as a dog trainer, it's always funny to me to go to conferences and seminars and have people say that, because I know that it's not true. But so much of this is a mindset piece. And so these are the kinds of things that that I think just they hold us back from making the kind of living that we could, and also just as importantly, in helping the number of dogs that we could and helping them as fully as we might as well.
All right, so let's go through those again, and then I think we can unpack them a little bit more, and there's some that personally I'd like to, but let's see where the conversation takes us. And also I'd like to add in the end here, after we've talked about it, so not now, I'm just giving the listeners a little bit of a window into what I hope we talk about later, but that is, you talked about mindset there, so I just want to kind of, I don't know how broad or how narrow we go on that conversation, but discuss some tips about how to change mindset. And maybe that is what we're talking about now, but maybe there will be room for like talking more specifically about that. Let's see how we go. So going back to number one, you said the first myth was we aren't skilled professionals. We don't think we're skilled professionals.
Yeah, and I see that reflected in a lot of ways. I see it reflected in the way we set our rates, in the lack of confidence we have in our marketing language, in the lack of confidence that we tend to bring to that sales moment. And all of that's really understandable. I mean, it's very human, right? You know, to sell is to set yourself up for rejection. And I certainly understand that. I often tell the story that I was a Girl Scout here in the States when I was growing up, and I loved it because I love camping and crafts crafts and all this sort of stuff. But I ended up quitting the Girl Scouts because back then you were required to sell the cookies. And the thing is, the cookies are delicious. Not like I didn't believe in the cookies, but I got to tell you, I was so profoundly uncomfortable going door to door selling these cookies that I just quit. I couldn't do it. And so, you know, I understand that, but I think, you know, so the thing that was so different, you know, in my mind is that when I'm going door to door selling cookies, I am knocking on your door when you're in the middle of something and asking you if you want something that you may not want. But when somebody invites us to their home or makes an appointment to come out to our facility, they're doing this because they want the help that we have to offer. And then I think that we don't take full advantage of that moment to offer that help, to believe in our own selves as trainers in terms of understanding the amount of training that's necessary and saying, you know, this is what a package needs to look like. You know, you think about, I feel like the way that so many of us handle these moments, it's kind of like if you know, you were sitting in a doctor's office and the doctor said, okay, well, you know, so I think, unfortunately, what's going on here is that you have this cancer. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, if you want to come back and do something about it, we could. I mean, what I'd probably recommend is, you know, I'm thinking to myself, like, oh, you know, that she really ought to have, you know, this many chemo appointments, but I don't know if I can sell that many. So I'll just see, you know, like, well, do you want like 3 or 6? When I know that really the number that this patient should have is 12. And there's just that sort of thing where we set ourselves and our clients and our dogs, their dogs, up for failure by underselling what we know is necessary to really actually help clients achieve what they come to us for. And then we also do things like, because we don't believe that we're skilled professionals, we buy into myths like the idea that a client has to train their own dog. And if you just think like and unpack that a little bit, it's so interesting. I mean, in what other profession, like just name one, people hire a professional in order to learn from the professional what they do. Like imagine, like we don't hire plumbers to come in and teach us how to fix a leak. We don't hire hairdressers to teach us how to cut our own hair. We don't hire doctors to teach us how to apply our own chemo treatments or lawyers to, you know, have us you know, teach us how to go into court and argue our own cases. Like, we hire professionals to take their professional knowledge and skill set and apply it on our behalf. But as dog trainers, what we're saying to clients when we say, I will show you how to do this and I'll show you like in 1 hour a week, think about what that says. We're literally saying that what we do is so simplistic and so easy that you could learn to do it effectively in just 1 hour a week. But think about like, you know, your ATA folks, like, right? I mean, ostensibly, I mean, think about like how much effort goes into learning everything that you learn, right? I mean, I'm assuming that almost everyone who's hearing our conversation has gone through at least one intensive training program, probably multiple, have all kinds of letters after their name, belong to associations, regularly do ongoing education, like what you provide. But then we undersell that. We're not giving that the credit it's due. And I think part of the reason for this, of course, is that in a largely unregulated industry, without, you know, super set standards, you know, you can't be a doctor without, you know, passing certain exams. You have to get a degree. You have to pass certain exams. There's a board that has to say that you are ready to do this. And I think I know from talking to so many of our one-on-one consulting clients, the clients who are just starting out, you know, the about 50% of our business that's helping new trainers start their businesses, you know, a lot of trainers are really uncertain. Do I know enough yet in order to safely begin to help people with their dogs? And I think that uncertainty is because there isn't a standardization of what we're supposed to know and how well we're supposed to do it. And I think we carry that insecurity around with us a lot.
First of all, the Girl Guide cookies are delicious. I absolutely agree with you. I don't know if we have the same ones here in New Zealand.
Do you have a favorite flavor?
Just Girl Guide flavor. That's really good.
Thin mints are the thin mints are the ones that are really popular.
I think
here
we've
in the
only
States.
Got one flavor here in New Zealand. That's why.
Oh no. Okay.
I don't know what I'm missing out on. You said that trainers are like potentially worried. Wrong word, I'm not sure. Tell me if there's a better word to inject there about selling their skills because that means that they might get rejected. Is that?
Well, the sales moment's uncomfortable, right? I mean, when you say to somebody, you know, when you make a proposal to someone, there is the potential for them to say no. And I think that very often that no feels very personal. And I think that that's, you know, one place where a mindset switch needs to take place, which is that we aren't going to be the right fit for everyone. And sometimes people investigate the notion of training, and then when they're faced with understanding what it really involves, both whether that's cost or time or their, you know, their own investment in the part of the work that they need to do, I think sometimes people just decide, you know, this isn't the right time, this isn't the right match for me. But it doesn't mean that we personally aren't the right match. But I think it's hard sometimes to distance ourselves, you know, from that feeling. And so it just feels uncomfortable. And so, you know, part of what we often teach, and this is one of the things that I'm going to be going into in a little bit more detail in the talks I'm doing there in New Zealand, is actually developing a script for this. I mean, you know, really developing a protocol, a practice that A, you know that you're using a strategy that is effective, and it's something that you can kind of memorize, sort of put your own personality spin around, and just practice it. Because the whole thing is, you know, when your stomach's doing butterflies and your heart's fluttering and all of that, in the beginning, if you can just fake it, right? If you can just get yourself to say what needs to be said so that you can hear a few yeses and be reinforced from that, it's amazing how the whole thing starts to take on so much less intensity. We find that with our clients and our students all the time, that it's about learning a process and a protocol so that you have a lot of confidence that the way you're going about it is ethical, is clean and comfortable both for you and for the client, and that it's effective. There are other things involved in this too, which I'll also be talking about in the workshops. And, you know, one of them that I'll mention is that a huge piece of successful sales is selling to the right people. And so there are all of these ways, all these little bits about how we set our businesses up that make an enormous difference. Because if we, and it has to do with how we set our rates, for example, how the marketing messages that we have on our websites, for example, there are all these different, and the way we do our marketing, what kind of referral sources, referral relationships we've built, et cetera, you're going to meet with so much more success selling the training the way you think it should be done if you are selling it to clients who are the right match for that service, right? No matter what our businesses are, no matter what industry you're in, you know, you're not going to be the right match for everyone. And so part of being successful is getting really, really clear about exactly how are my services supposed to be used to have, you know, to work for me financially, to have maximum impact for my clients and their dogs. And who are those clients? And how do I make sure that they're the ones that I'm selling to? There's no point in selling something to someone who's not going to be the right match for it. You just set yourself up for failure and discomfort, which just, you know, continues that cycle.
Going back just a little bit there, you were talking about actually developing a script. Sorry, I'm rewinding a little bit. Sorry, listeners. I'm
that is
it again.
Okay. Well, with me anyway, I can't speak for the listeners.
Well, they keep coming back, so I'm assuming that you're okay with the rabbit holes that my mind explores on this show. So you say actually developing a script, like, so knowing what you're going to say when you go in there, and then, because we talked about this before off the podcast, just in amongst friends, and I'm thinking back to a podcast episode we did with Ava Bertelsen where we talked about flowcharting out your training sessions so you know what you're going to do at every possible behavior the animal might throw at you. So, and we talked about how that as an animal trainer in your training sessions can help build your confidence. So am I going down a path that resonates with you? Is that what you're kind of suggesting here? Like, know what you're going to say. Know if the client says this, this is what you say. If the client says that, this is what you say. And you kind of know, you have the whole conversation mapped out. And I guess that means that you're not thinking on the spot in front of the client.
Yes. That's exactly what I mean. And I love training analogies for business. Yeah, and it goes even further than that. So you've got you've got the basic script, and then you've got the all of those all those spin-off pieces. So, you know, when somebody says, well, oh gosh, you know, what about, gosh, this is a little bit expensive. You know, do you think we could just like try a couple sessions first and see how it is? Like, I want you to know what you're going to say when you get that question, because I know you're going to get it every once in a while. And I want you to feel super confident so that when you answer the question, the client's like, whoa, I want this trainer. And even if you've, even if you're quaking in your boots the first few times, and so, yeah, I mean, really, and it goes back even farther than that. It's not even just the script, which is a hugely important part. It's also understanding exactly where in the initial consult process does this script come out, right? When do you initiate this conversation? How do you initiate this conversation in a way that feels smooth, in a way that feels, you know, it doesn't feel icky and slimy and carnival barky and pushy. It should just feel natural. But what usually happens is that trainers, we tend to miss the moment, and partly it's because we don't make the moment. And so that's part of what we teach in this too, is exactly what is the structure of initial consult. I think a lot of times, you know, we go in and they just kind of happen, but we haven't sort of really spent the time to say, okay, these are the goals of an initial consult, and this is exactly how I'm going to achieve those goals, and to actually run the process, to control the process, to lead the client, where you want them to go, because A, they called you there for to be led, and also, you know it's in their best interest. And so rather than going in and feeling kind of just floaty in the whole thing, really having a step-by-step-by-step model that you're following so that there's this natural progression into the moment of, okay, so are we going to do this together? I want that to feel so smooth for trainers, because I want them to master it, because it means more clients, which means more dogs helped.
So I've come up with a saying, don't feel floaty, feel flowy.
Right. I will start using that, and I will make sure you get credit.
So you said there that sometimes people might be quaking in their boots the first few times. And when you were saying that, it reminded me of learning about crucial conversations. And when I was learning about crucial conversations, I'd go have these conversations with people, and it felt so awkward and weird because I had no reinforcement history for it. It was so out of my normal patterns of behavior, out of my comfort zone. But that's what you're suggesting, like potentially – maybe rephrase that question. You're suggesting that's one possible way you could do that. It's kind of like learn this, but then you've got to take that next step and put yourself in that position.
Yeah. You know, and it's something that I'll confess to you, when we started in 2003, one of the big questions in my mind, so we started this whole endeavor because when I was director of behavior and training at the SBCA in San Francisco, that was back when Gene Donaldson's Academy was part of the department. And we kept watching all these amazing trainers graduate from this program. You know, we'd have 14 cadres of students graduate every year. And then we'd check back in with them, and we'd find that they were failing. You know, they had gone back to jobs that they had meant, you know, that they had quit to become a trainer, or they were working part-time because they couldn't get the business to go full-time. We realized that learning to be a trainer wasn't enough. You had to be able to run a business. And so that's where the whole idea for Dog Tech, which has now become Dog Biz, all started. And overall, I felt really confident that we could teach these business skills. The one thing that was in my mind that I just wasn't sure about at the time was, what about the sales part? You know, like if you're not a natural salesperson, like to what extent can you actually master this? Like how much is it about, personality, and how, was that going to get in the way? And I can say with complete confidence and a great deal of relief 16 years later that it's just a skill set. It's not dependent on personality. The only rule of personality is that it's more comfortable for some people in the beginning than others, right? It's more natural for some people than others. But we have worked with Oh, God. I mean, people who are profoundly, profoundly uncomfortable doing this, who now are awesome, effective salespeople who don't have the discomfort that they had before, right? It's, I mean, it really can become, if you learn a protocol and you go in and you do it, and then it works, and you get some reinforcement from doing that, and the clients, you know, you get the reinforcement in the sale, plus you get the reinforcement of the client telling you this was so amazing, and it was, you know, it was worth every dollar, and they're so thrilled, and it was one of the best decisions they've ever made. And like, there's a point where you just don't feel the same level of discomfort in offering your services to someone. That whole emotional underpinning thing just finally gets kind of switched off, or at least significantly dampened.
To quote Dr. Susan Friedman, emotions track contingencies. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Love it.
Number three, so we're talking about sales now, and number three for you was, and maybe I've got this in the wrong order, but one of the next
Jumping around.
is marketing has to equal self-promotion. But you're saying, get rid of that. It's fog.
Totally blow that up. So this has been a big theme throughout our 16 years as well, right? I mean, I have met, I bet I can count on my hand the number of dog trainers I've met who really, really, really love marketing. And I have met many, 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 many dog trainers. I don't know very many people, very many trainers who actively enjoy marketing. Or at least not who did before we got a hold of them. I will say that I'm quite pleased to say that a lot of our clients and students come to love marketing. But, you know, most of us don't start out geeking out about it. And I there's this whole, you know, again, I said in the beginning, you know, all of the different reasons for the discomfort around it. We have spent 16 years trying to figure out what to do about that. And, you know, in the beginning, you know, we were teaching, you know, marketing techniques that we knew would be effective, and clients were saying to us, oh gosh, that sounds like a great idea, but couldn't you just do it for us? And so we're like, oh yeah, well, sure. And so we created things like the marketing toolkit and the newsletter service, where, you know, we were doing as much of the marketing work for clients as possible, but there's still that sort of, you know, tendency to be, you know, nervous about carrying it out. And the thing that has just really, I think, for us kind of revolutionized this and helped our clients learn to at least not hate marketing anymore, and for some of them to actually really embrace it and enjoy it and feel passionate about it, is a mindset shift. A mindset shift from marketing as self-promotion to marketing as education. So you can do marketing that's all about going out there and proclaiming from the hilltops how awesome you are, or you can do marketing that's about showing people what you can do for them. And while you're doing that, actually providing useful content, education. And so one of the things that every dog trainer I have ever met is crazy passionate about is teaching, right? We want people to know what we know. We want them to learn new ways of thinking about their dogs. We want them to get rid of old myths about their dogs. We want them to, you know, learn to use positive reinforcement. We want them to learn how important puppy socialization is. We want them to learn, you know, how to teach a sit so that they can use that as the foundation, you know, of you know, all the other behavior and a way to, you know, promote, you know, polite interactions between dogs and their people and improve the bond between dogs. And like, we have all these things that we want to teach. And what if instead of thinking about marketing as promotion, we think about marketing as an opportunity to teach those things? And so that's really what we have spent most of our time doing, is teaching people how to market that way, and just getting more and more and more creative about it over the years, finding more and more ways to do that work so that trainers can feel good about the marketing. I mean, so, you know, if you are thinking about marketing as community education, that's marketing you can feel good about, right? And what's really cool about it too is that one of the things that I love about dog trainers is that we want to make a living doing what we love, but we also, this isn't just about making money, right? I mean, we do this because we really want to help. We really want to change dogs' lives. And there, again, as I said earlier, even if you scale your business, even if you hire other trainers, there are only so many dogs you can help at a given time, whether you're doing classes or whether you're doing private training. You know, there is a limit in volume to the amount of work that you can do. And so if you approach your marketing from a community education standpoint, you're now helping that many more dogs in your community as well. And it's we find that it's a much, much, much more effective way of marketing this kind of a service than, you know, throwing money at advertising and you know, self-promotional flyers and things like that. So it works better, you know, and it has this added benefit of actually helping dogs and people.
So you're saying all of that money I just spent on making little Ryan Cartlidge action figures was a waste of time?
Okay, you have to make sure I get one of those when I'm in Wellington in November. I must have one.
I enjoy marketing when it's going well. But people listening to this podcast show, I mean, I love making this podcast show, but ATA has been successful because of this podcast show.
Yeah.
And all I'm doing is sitting in my office talking to you, which is a ridiculous amount of fun, but this is the reason ATA is successful. So I resonate with that really strongly. I like
yeah.
It.
So this podcast is exactly that kind of marketing. This is community education marketing, right? That's what you're doing. So while you are promoting, so you're focused right now on finding people to talk to bring education and ideas to your followers. And it just so happens that as you do that, ATA gets marketed as well. It gets promoted, right? It just, but your passion for providing the education and the ideas and the conversation, that's what makes, it's probably what makes it fun for you and for your listeners, but it's also what makes it effective as marketing. I mean, you can pay for an advertisement to tell people about ATA, but they're not going to have anywhere near the understanding of what that program can do for them that they have by participating in this project.
Absolutely love this conversation, and we should do a whole episode on, I call it content marketing. I don't know if that's a phrase you do.
Yeah. Content marketing, community marketing, same thing. Yeah, exactly.
I love this topic, but we're looking at time. We should probably move on because that was point number three and there's eight of them. So number four, I've got written down here, the myth is clients will only hire a dog trainer if it's cheap.
Yep. Well, in the interest of time, I'll make this one short, which is just to say it's absolutely not true. And the reality is that the more you charge, the more clients you'll have. And I know that sounds completely backwards, but it bears out over and over and over again. Trainers are terrified to raise their rates, thinking I don't have enough business as it is, and then they raise their rates and they find that they need to call us back because they have too much business. That wonderful problem to have. So the reality is that if you don't value your services, other people won't either. And the serious clients who are really looking for a solution, they're going to hire the more expensive trainer. And one of the things that we see a lot, we get asked when I'm speaking, we get asked by our consulting clients, that this tremendous frustration about people who go to the traditional trainer down the street first before coming to the positive reinforcement trainer, and then we have to we have to fix the damage, right? And there's always like, why are they going to that person first? They're more expensive. I'm like, well, honestly, one of the reasons they go to that person is because they're more expensive, and they assumed you weren't as good because you were less expensive. And that is just a reality. And I have traveled doing this work in countries all over the world, and I have never seen that rule different anywhere I've gone.
I wrote something down earlier and then I deleted it, but it's come back to me as you were talking then. When we were talking about scripting out your conversations with your clients and the awkwardness around doing that sometimes when you first get started, and how doing that repetitively, getting your reinforcement history down, can improve your confidence, and going back even further to something I said that I wanted to talk about, which was mindset in general. Is that something you're suggesting that we do, is kind of just putting ourselves in those positions and embracing this stuff and trialing it out and getting reinforcement history to gain confidence, and that changes our mindset? Because if these are all myths, then the idea is to think about them differently, to do both of those things or something else. Like how do we change the mindset?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think, you know, part of it is thinking about it differently. And so that's why we do things like trying to reframe the concept of marketing, for example. It's part of why we, you know, it's part of why we try to tell so many stories about, you know, to bring, like, you can try this and it can be scary, but I want you to know that you're not the first person to try it, right? When you know, we're experimenting with class structures, we're not experimenting with your businesses. And so, you know, we know from years and years and years of working with trainers to do this that this holds true. And so just to know that, and to look around you and see too what happens in your own community, who are the trainers that that are getting the most traction, that sort of thing. I mean, it's just that mindset comes partly from considering, you know, evidence and alternatives and that sort of thing. But yes, it also comes partly from the experience of sometimes you just have to take the deep breath and make a change and then be reinforced for that. And it's part of why, you know, we do a lot of scripting. We do a lot of scripting for our clients. We do a lot of scripting in the courses that, you know, we teach, you know, depending on the topic and whatnot. It's one of the things I'll be doing in the talks that I'm coming out in November for, is, you know, really walking through, you know, that whole sales protocol and scripting. And then what I always encourage people to do is then take that basic, you know, word for word piece and make it yours, right? You have to say it in a way that feels natural, the kind of words you use, the sort of cadence and rhythm you have, so that when you use it, it flows out, even if you're feeling nervous that first time that you're doing it. But yeah, I mean, I think my mindset is, sometimes it's about, you know, thinking differently. Sometimes it's about doing differently and letting the emotions and the thoughts come along for the ride.
And does this come down to, we talked about marketing maybe coming down to, not coming down, that's the wrong way of saying it, but personality, individualism, having an effect on people when they're first embracing these ideas. Does that come into effect here? Do you find that it's, you can learn this stuff, or have you found that some people, I know that you can learn this stuff because that's what you're telling us, obviously that's what you do, but what I'm asking is something in a very poorly worded way, is personality, like people, some people more inclined to take risks, is the fact that people are already doing business, like, kind of put someone in the category that they're going to be taking risks?
I think that's a great point. One of the things that I love about what I do for a living is that I work with people who have decided to follow their passion for a living, right? I mean, I work with so many people who are doing something that's really scary. Starting a business is a big, risky endeavor. And then you throw in the fact that the vast majority of dog trainers who do that because they kind of have to, because it's not like there's a ton of jobs floating around for dog trainers. And so, you know, very often, you know, we do it sort of out of necessity, as, you know, because we want to pursue our passion. And I think that's amazing. I mean, I think about the number of, you know, trainers that we've worked with over the years who have been crazy excited to do this, but also really scared. I mean, nervous, freaked out, anxious. But they're doing it anyway. And to me, that is so amazing. I just have so much admiration for our clients, our students, for dog trainers in general who go out and do this work. And so it's one of the things that, yeah, I mean, exactly. If you, even if it scares you to death, if you're going to go out and start a business, then I'll tell you, even though it's really scary to learn sales skills, maybe it feels really scary to learn marketing skills, the reality is that as soon as you do that, it takes a ton of the fear out of owning a business, right? It's really scary to figure out how to optimally set your rates. But once you've learned how to do it and you make the commitment to yourself based on, you know, based on those strategies to set your rates where they should be for you, and it starts working, it just, you think about, you know, a huge part of this is just, we've already taken the big step. Now we just have to take a few more of them to make sure that that big step is not for naught, right? That we, you got to be all in. And it's just a little bit farther. I mean, you just got to go a little bit farther down the path so that you really get where you want to be. I don't know, you know, it's interesting what you say about personality. I mean, yeah, I think for some people making these choices is easier than for others. But the reality is, you know, once you make them and commit and go, personality, I think, has much less, it may play some role in making the choice to do it. I don't think it plays very much role in how successful you then are afterward. Because I know lots and lots of wallflower trainers who have learned to be amazing sales and marketing people who, if you had had a conversation with them early on, they wouldn't have predicted it. And I don't think anyone else from the outside looking would have either.
It's interesting. And I always think about like the ATA membership as the people that I look at to represent the wider ATA podcast audience and ATA audience. But I'm also curious, like, are these just the ones that have stayed in the game and have some people dropped off because they didn't have the confidence, the risk-taking willingness, or the... I don't know what other words I'm looking for here, but yeah, are we kind of interacting more with the people that are getting successful? I'm going down a deep rabbit hole here, and it's
yeah, I don't know.
That's
interesting. I mean, I'm just going to conjecture, but you know, do some people's businesses fail? Yes. Is some of that because people quit before they've done everything that could be done? Yeah, I see that occasionally, but to be honest, I really think that. Mostly what we see, and you know, this is of course anecdotal. I'm not speaking from a bunch of data here, but when I think anecdotally over the 16 years we've been doing this, I really do think that what you said earlier about just deciding to start the business, that's the really big scary one. And what we do see some of is some people will start businesses, they'll start the process of starting a business, and they won't actually finish that process. So they'll not actually see it all the way to fruition. I see that happen more often than people go ahead and start it and then get scared and stop. I think there's a, you know, okay, I think when people drop out, it's usually a little bit earlier in the ride. That's my impression.
We're going to jump out of this rabbit hole because there's two myths I don't know we've touched on yet, and if we have, we've kind of brushed over them. And that is one, that students will come back for more if they like the instructor and class. You're saying that's a myth.
Yeah, well, so it's interesting. So we're this course that we're doing in September, the best classes in town, the Dog Biz University class, one of the things that that I open with in that class is, you know, so we're going to explore, you know, all the different various kinds of challenges and kind of build an understanding about, you know, why these things are so challenging and why they happen, and then what do we do about them. But before we do that, we need to lay a really, really clear foundation, which is understanding what success is. And I think that too often we tend to think about successful, our parameter, you know, our standard for what a successful class is the students had fun and they liked the instructor, and the dogs performed well in class, right? Like those are the three things we tend to think about. And if you look at the kinds of questions that are on most trainers' evaluation forms, it has a lot to do with that. When you think about, like, I think about, you know, conversations that I have with trainers, and they talk about how they feel about their classes, and they might be really frustrated with you know, how well the classes are filling or the retention of them, or maybe they're struggling to figure out, you know, how to deal with all of the different levels of students in their classes and things like that. But they'll say that their classes, you know, feel successful because this, you know, the students have a good time. And so they don't understand, like, why aren't they coming back if they've had a really good time? And they, and my evals look great, and yet people aren't coming back after Puppy or Basic, right? And the thing is, because that's not the right parameter. So people can have a great time and they can totally love the instructor and the dog can rock it in class. But what matters is the experience they're having in class making a, you know, a true difference in their life outside of the classroom with the dog. We're looking at the wrong things. We're building course structure to solve the wrong problems. We're building curriculum to solve the wrong problems. It's not about whether students are having fun, but, you know, of course we want them to. And it's not about whether they like the instructor, although of course we want that to happen as well. And it's not about whether the dog can perform a sit stay in class, although of course we'd love to see that happen. They're not going to come back if it's not having an impact on their lives outside of class. And the vast majority of dog training curriculum out there is not designed to make that happen. That's why we see things, that's why, you know, I mean, you know, who among us has not heard a student say, oh, he's always good when you're standing there, or he always does great in class, but I can't get him to do it at home, or I can't get him to do it out in the park. And that's because our curriculum doesn't teach for that. Our curriculum is so focused on people learning how to get dog behavior in the classroom that that's why people don't come back. I tell the story about when I took over as director at the SPCA in San Francisco. We had a huge public training class program there. And the first day that I took over in that position, there was a graduation class going on, and I slipped in to watch that class. And it was people were having a blast. The dogs were doing great. You know, the instructor was, you know, a really lively, engaging person, and, you know, she'd set this whole kind of graduation course up, and the, you know, the people and their dogs were walking from station to station and doing all kinds of, you know, whatever the instruction there said, and they were nailing it. It was just fabulous. And there was graduation music and whatnot. And as she was releasing class, I went out and stood outside the course, you know, where the cars were, and watched everybody come out. And I'll never forget, and I'm sure you know, we've all seen something like this, that one of the women in class came out with her dog, and she's trying to unlock the car door, and she's digging around in her purse for the keys, and she's holding the dog on leash, and she's got her graduation certificate, which she's clearly proud of. She's trying very hard not to crumple it. And it's San Francisco, so she's also holding a latte, and she's trying to, you know, trying to get the dog and just get into the car. And another student and their dog come out, and these two dogs like each other, so her dog starts to pull toward the other dog, and she's trying to tell him, you know, no, hey, stop that. And she eventually gets frustrated and jerks the dog. And I had just witnessed her do a wait, a sit, a stay, a loose leash walk, like all of these things brilliantly in class. And it did not occur to her, not 5 minutes later, to use those tools in the parking lot, because we don't teach for that. And it seems, and to us, we're so frustrated as instructors. We're like, oh my God, I just taught you that. How can you not? But literally, our curriculum does not actually teach that. And so that's, you know, a big piece of this. The only way that people come back is if it's making a difference in their real lives. We need to rethink how we teach classes, how we structure them. There's just so much that we can do to improve on classes in this industry. You can tell I'm a little bit passionate about this topic, just a little bit.
Yeah, and once again, I mean, everything we've talked about today is just a whole podcast episode in and of itself. Nice. There was one more myth, and that was that clients want to fix their relationships with their dogs, which kind of flows quite nicely from what you were just talking about.
Yeah, this one's really, there are very, very few things that even positive reinforcement trainers agree on, right? But it's like, it seems like one of the really strong themes is that we all want to improve the bond between clients and their dogs, between students and their dogs. The thing is, that is not why the client or the student comes to us, and we have got to get this into our heads. because what we're doing, and part of the reason that we're having a difficult time getting clients, is that we're marketing around this message. So this is a goal that we have as dog trainers, to improve the bond between people and their dogs. That is not a marketing message. Nobody wakes up in the morning thinking, you know, I think I want to improve the relationship with my dog, or I think my bond with my dog needs a little bit of work. I think I'm going to go looking for a dog trainer. People wake up in the morning and they say, I swear to God, if he does that one more time, or, you know, darn it, if she blows me off again, right? It's people go to dog trainers because their dog is doing something or not doing something, not because they think they have a relationship problem. And so if we want to fix the relationship problem that we perceive, our marketing has to speak to what they're experiencing and what they want to have happen. And this is another reason that often traditional trainers get the business that we as positive reinforcement trainers want and should have. And it's because they're out there telling people that they're going to fix their problems, and we're telling them that they have a problem with their relationship with their dog, which they do not perceive. And so that's a big piece of this, is we've got to get savvier about our marketing messages. Now, we're never going, I want to be really super, super clear. I don't want to be misunderstood as saying that we should be using the kind of pushy marketing that we often see with traditional training, or that we should be making, you know, guarantees that are unethical or anything like that. But really, just stop to think about it. If we cannot find an effective way to tell people that we can make their lives with their dogs better, that we can help change their dog's behavior, if we aren't confident enough to say that, we have no business offering our services. We stop short, well short of guarantees, but we have to be thinking in a more savvy way about what we say to clients, about what we do, and how it impacts their lives.
So in no particular order, 8 myths that we as...
I don't think there was any order to that at all.
8 business myths of dog training professionals that we talked about and touched on at some point in some rabbit hole today is dog trainers can't make a good living, myth number one. We aren't skilled professionals, myth number two. Clients must train their own dogs, myth number three. Students will come back for more if they like the instructor and class, myth number five. You have to be born with good sales skills. That was myth number six. Have I got this right?
You're going to end up with 9, because the 8 really add up to the big myth that you can't make a living as a dog trainer.
Ah, so I've already covered that one.
So just go for the 9. It's all
I just
good.
Saw that I had more than that.
We're giving them a bonus.
Bonus. You got it here for listening to us this deep into this episode. Marketing has to equal self-promotion is myth number 7. Myth number 8 is clients want to fix their relationships with their dogs. And the last one is clients will only hire a dog trainer if it's cheap. Now, for those of you in Australasia, you are very lucky that you will get to unpack all of this later on in the year, over the coming months, because for those of us in this part of the world, Veronica will be visiting us very shortly. Can you please share with everyone, Veronica, a little bit more about your upcoming trip?
Yes. I am going to, I'm coming out, hosted by the New Zealand APDT, to do 3 one-day business talks. I'm going to be, and what I'll be doing at these talks is going into a lot more depth on these myths, but more importantly, more depth on the solutions to them. Really looking for, you know, a really... to spend a whole day together. I want you to come away with tips and tweaks and ahas and really actionable items for taking your business from wherever it is right now to wherever you'd like to see it go, and having an awful lot of fun, I hope, together doing so. I will be in Auckland on November 9th. I will be in Wellington, your neck of the woods, Ryan, on the 16th of November. And I will be in Christchurch on November 23rd. I am also, for those of you in Australia, I'm also going to be a little bit after, on December 5th, I'm going to be doing a small workshop, a one-day workshop in Adelaide, called Reset for Success. And in that one, we'll be looking at some of these myths and whatnot, but we're actually going to be doing a little bit of workshopping in that one as well. And so, yeah, I'm excited.
And so if you're in any of these areas, then where can we go to find out more?
So for the New Zealand talks, you go to the New Zealand APDT site and register through the APDT. And for the Adelaide talk in on December 5th is what I said, right? And the Adelaide talk, December 5th, you go to dogbizsuccess.com/reset-for-success.
Perfect. And we will link to all of this in the show notes as well. Hey, Veronica, this has been so much fun from myself and on behalf of everyone listening. We really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today with us. And I'll see you in November.
I am looking forward to it. Thank you so much for having me.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much everyone for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.